Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Welcome to the latest episode of The Book Club on Football Ramble Presents. I'm Kate Mason.
I'm Jim Campbell.
And today we're taking you on a journey into the heart of the Swedish underworld to understand how a promising footballer went from taking his team to the cusp of promotion in 2009 to being murdered months later at the hands of a criminal network whose influence on his hometown extends to this day.
Khoury looked down at the much shorter Eddie, who, undeterred by the difference in size, returned his gaze and unleashed a torrent of abuse. You're behind the murder of Mohamed. I'm going to fucking hire people to take you out. I'm going to pay so much fucking money to teach you a lesson.
This is a true story whose subject matter was so dangerous that the original publisher refused to print it and whose author was nearly driven out of her home by the death threats of a mob boss. But she persisted, and when it was finally released in Sweden, the first edition sold out within a week and became the most popular book in the country's maximum security prisons. Now it's out in English to unnerve and entrance readers the world over. This week for Book Club, we're reading Follow Fucking Orders by Anne Turnquist.
Khoury ignored them, as he had done for most of his life. The cops have always hated me, he says. And he drove his cousin to hospital, where the doctors did save his life. But nothing could fix the damage from one of the bullets that had burrowed into his spine, paralysing him from the waist down.
When Anne started her research into the death of a star footballer and his brother, she could not know that it would lead to 5 years spent tracking down witnesses, or that someone she became close to in the process would end up dead. All she wanted to do was understand how a quaint town near Stockholm had become the site of a bloody turf war, and how one particular gangster now believed he ran the place. And I'm delighted to say, in a first for Book Club, we have a crime reporter with us today, the author of Follow Fucking Orders, Anne Turnquist. Joins us now down the line from Sweden. Anne, thank you so much for taking the time to join us for Book Club.
Yeah, no, thank you. I'm glad to be part of this.
So Anne, the book focuses around Södertälje, the town I mentioned in the introduction, and it centres around the events that led up to the trial of the mob boss, Bernard Khoury, who apparently ordered the execution of the best footballer in the local side. It is an extraordinary world to be involved in, and it had huge personal consequences for you. At what stage or how much did you ever consider giving up on getting this book out there?
Well, the thing is, I actually never considered giving up. I had I thought when I started this, I'm like, oh, a book is like a long feature article. This will take me 6 months. I mean, like laugh out loud. It's not. A book is a totally different beast. And I ended up taking like 5 years, but so I had more like 3 years into this thing. You know, I started with, oh my God, why did these gangsters end up so like violent, you know, with a lot of empathy for them. And then 3 years down the line, I'm like, I know why they ended up like this, because they're all a-holes. So it was more like, you know, I just got to a point where my curiosity about them was totally spent, but I'd gotten so far and the story still fascinated me. So I just, it was more like taking a bit of a pause and like, you know, reloading, getting some energy. But then I'm trying to remember. So it was like, I was about to publish the book, and then the mob boss, whom you mentioned, Bernard Currie, his family started ringing me and they're like, oh, what book is this? And I was a bit confused because he knew I was writing a book. But then I realized, because he'd given me one initial interview, and then after he was convicted, he didn't give me a second interview because, you know, I wasn't useful to him anymore. There was no chance of being acquitted. And because he's such a narcissist, he must have just assumed that, like, oh, I didn't give her permission, so she stopped. Whereas, you know, and I actually got a letter from him in prison where he's like, I know that the constitution is really strong and that Sweden has one of the most solid press freedom laws in the world. I'm like, somebody did their research to see if they could stop me legally. And then the death threat came, like the prison actually warned me. They phoned me, one of the weirdest phone calls in my life. And, you know, people were like, oh my God, are you going to publish it? And for me, it was more like, I've never wanted to publish it more. Like, not just because, you know, my personality is just like, I'm sorry, excuse me, who do you think you are? But also, I was a journalist being threatened by a mob boss. And once you let criminals like silence the press, you might as well throw the constitution in the ocean.
Mm. So the gang that you're talking about, and you obviously talk about throughout the book, they're known as the Network. Can you take us and the listeners through a kind of brief explanation of how they operate and how you came to be interested in them?
Well, so they operate in this small town called Södertälje. It's about half an hour south of Stockholm. It's an old industrial town. It's still an industrial town. AstraZeneca is based there. It's very cute. It's old. But it also has always had a lot of immigration from different countries. And it has a very large and also very tight-knit community of people who are Orthodox Christians who came here from the Middle East because of persecution. Not always easy to be Christian in the Middle East. So, it's, you know, in many ways, the community is lovely. Like, people take care of each other. They're super welcoming. But they also kind of, like, keep a bit to themselves. And if there's a conflict, they call in a mediator. The football player's brother was a very well-respected mediator. But what happened was, they also had like an informal kind of underworld, not like an underworld economy, but as in like, if you wanted to expand your business, you would borrow money from a local community leader rather than the banks. And you would have to pay it back. And that kind of worked for many years. But then when Bernard came of age, my impression of him is that he's not just capable of violence, but actually really enjoys violence. So they're loan sharks. And the demands became like unreasonable. And the mother of three is in the book. I mean, her family were confronted when like Bernard and his friends just like pushed their way into their home and said, oh, your son owes us the equivalent to £1,000. And all of a sudden they were like, oh, we need a... £30,000. I mean, that's not even reason. I mean, that's what kind of math is this? Yeah. I was trying to like convert it to percentage and just gave up. So like from a £1,000 to £30,000.
And so it's just like an arbitrary sum, is it basically?
They were like annoyed that he'd borrowed the money from like a rival gang and like, you know, and they'd been after him and he's like, oh, I know Bernard. And he's like, how dare you drop my name? You know, it was just so much like honor and like, reminding people who was in charge. And the Network, I mean, they took a lot of drugs. So I don't think they were totally in control of their senses. So that kind of stuff. And that's also why people in the end just got really fed up because could you guys like conjure up £30,000 in 1 week's time?
Well, Jim could, but I would struggle.
I would struggle, I've got to be honest. Sorry to dash your illusions there, Kate, and my lavish lifestyle. But it's unreasonable. But surely they know that's unreasonable. You know, surely they surely making the figure that high means they're not going to get the money.
But the problem is, the problem is that they did. I mean, people bought, so people would be totally desperate. And you know, the network didn't even have to. These are men in like their late 20s and like early 30s, and they're so known for violence. And so you just, I mean, you will find that money. I mean, you borrow it from friends. You sell stuff. I mean, in that family, the mother had these gold jewelry that was part of her dowry once upon a time, you know, sentimental jewelry. And she sold that. And so what the mother of three, who's one of the main characters in the book, says, is just like, they can demand this because people will find the money, and people have found the money, and they know this.
So this is a core part of the book, isn't it? What you do so well is to trace this sense of obligation and the way that the power networks are built up in this town. And is it that fear of violence? Is that basically the main mechanism of control, would you say, Anne?
Yeah, because, you know, they've kidnapped people, they've assaulted people. I mean, it's not like their propensity for violence is news to anyone. And also, I mean, one thing you have to keep in mind is that Bernard Currie is huge. He's like 6'3" and has incredibly broad shoulders. He's an imposing figure. I mean, his nickname is the tall one.
Al-Tawil, isn't it?
Yeah. So in Arabic, Al-Tawil, I'm probably mincing the pronunciation, means the tall one. But the funny thing is that the Swedish cops, all these like blonde, blue-eyed, you know, do-gooders, were like, I'm going to help this town get over their woes. They were like, they kept like transcribing it in like weird ways. So when you read the police case file, like they're obviously really struggling. And people had to explain to them, it's Arabic. It means the tall one. And also like, you know, and it was used. I mean, like when they were extorting people, they'd be like, oh, you know, the tall one. They wouldn't even say his name because they didn't have to.
Like Voldemort's.
Yeah. You know, actually, that's really funny because I gave an interview to the local paper, Sotelia, after one of my interview people, didn't go that well for her. And I said to the local reporter, I'm like, do you know what? I really hope that Voldemort is sitting in his isolation cell and feeling a bit of shame about this, but I bet he isn't. And I go back, and I went back to my job. I was working for like public service radio at the time, like the equivalent to the BBC. And I went to my boss, Karen. I'm like, Karen, do you think maybe it's a problem that I called Bernard Currie Voldemort? And she's like my boss. I mean, she's an old crime reporter, so she got it. And she's like, she's like, it's not like I wouldn't employ you because you said that, but I think you might want to consider how much you want to provoke them, you know?
So in this town, obviously you've described it as being a sort of very pretty industrial town with a lot of kind of complicated social makeup. But within the town is Asiriska, which is the local football team, who, and again, I may not be pronouncing that right, but they seem to be a little bit of a beacon for people of an Assyrian background. And Eddie Musa, the player in question, he was murdered, was a bit of a symbol for that community as well. Is that fair to say?
No, it's totally fair to say. I mean, so it's pronounced Assyriska because an Assyrian person is Assyrisk in Swedish. I mean, they were doing so well. So the first generation moved to Södertälje in the early 1970s. And they formed their own like football team, and they're super successful. They're like great businessmen. They've built like their own churches. And then they established a Assyriska, and it was just like, you know, they had like a muddy pitch around the corner for a while, which is still there. But now they have a huge stadium. I am going to get to my point. No, and the thing is, so I was actually living abroad when they made it up into like the Swedish equivalent of the Premier League. And I remember being like, wow, that's really cool. I mean, like they were underdogs. I mean, they really came from nowhere. And all of a sudden they're in the top league. Then they didn't manage to stay there. This was 2005, if I remember correctly. So what happens and what's in the book is that they're in the second division, and they're slowly like actually playing so well that they have a chance. And there are two playoffs. Is it called playoffs? No, it's not called playoffs.
Mm.
Yeah,
it's a playoff. It's a two legs of a playoff. Yeah, it's exactly. Yeah. It. So the first leg, he's running the game, Eddie Musa, isn't he?
Yeah, so they have these playoffs, and there's a picture in the book which I love because people keep saying that they keep mentioning that he's really short, and they keep mentioning that he's really fast. And there's this picture when he's playing, they're playing against their local rivals who have these like very dramatic red, this red and yellow strip. And he's just surrounded by defenders. And these defenders look like giants compared to him. But he's in this, like, he's just about to like maneuver the ball away from them. And he's just like, he looks so powerful. Like it's almost like this David Goliath picture. And I think, you know, this thing about a picture says more than 1,000 words. This is rarely true, but sometimes you get a picture where you're like, damn, that's it. So he was great. He was injured, however. So he had to be subbed off in the second playoff, which meant that it was a bit difficult to get into the Premier League. But people loved him and he was really charming. And, you know, I've spoken to people who grew up with him and she's like, you know, we used to go to summer camp and we'd sit up late and he'd be telling jokes and everyone would just be like laughing. And of course he was complicated because he was a bit macho and a little bit vain as well. And a bit flirty, which not everyone appreciated. But then what people didn't know is that he was also kind of a loan shark, but like low level at the beginning, because he would gamble at night. And if someone lost a hand and ran out of cash, he'd be like, oh, I'll spot you 100 quid. But if you win the next hand, you'll have to give me back like 200. I mean, that's a return rate of what, 100%. So, and Bernard Currie, who essentially had the monopoly on loans within ironic, sarcastic quotation marks, didn't appreciate this. And then things just kind of, well, basically they went to hell within the space of 6 months. There was one murder, then there was a retaliation drive-by shooting when Bruno's cousin is paralyzed. And then there's the other retaliation where Eddie Musa is gunned down with a Kalashnikov. I mean, he's like shot 17 times. The cop, the first responder, one of the first responders who had to like physically hold Eddie Musa's mother back from running to the crime scene had basically heard from the first responders inside the venue that you could barely recognize him. Like he was just like torn to shreds. And he was basically like, you know, I can't let a mother see this. And Eddie's big brother, the respected mediator that I mentioned was also there and they shot him in the throat. So that's just like a plain execution. And the thing is, for me, I mean, I wasn't a crime reporter at the time, but this was the first time I heard of like a Kalashnikov, like the semi-automatic Soviet/Yugoslavian rifle being used. And, you know, I grew up in the 80s when everything was like cute and it was so prosperous and we were like the social democratic utopia and the local newspapers had a headline about like a bike being stolen or like a kitten getting stuck in a tree. And I remember being like, I'm sorry, when did we start murdering each other with Kalashnikovs in Sweden? You know, it's obviously like something had changed during the years when I was studying and working abroad. So I'll just briefly say that the thing about this book as well, it's like I was abroad, including the UK for a long time, for so long that like writing and researching this book was almost like me rediscovering my country, a country that had changed when I was away.
And of course, these communities that you're talking about, many of them are immigrant populations coming in and creating their own environment within this, what you say was previously a kind of quaint Swedish town. But when you're saying that, certainly in the UK, that would probably have a different vibe about it. You know, there's always this concern about talking about the idea of immigrant populations bringing in crime and this sort of thing, and you talk about Sweden being this like utopian setup. Does it have the same, was it being approached in a similar way, do you remember? Were people saying, oh, you know, this is the result of
well, the thing is, I think that this case, and it ended up being the biggest ever investigation into organized crime in Sweden, it was kind of new in the way that the prosecutors during the investigation, also when they brought charges, talked a lot about this community and how they, you know, kept to themselves. But they also talked about it with a great deal of empathy, as in, like, we understand why people do this because they were treated so badly in the Middle East. And also during the Ottoman Empire, like 100 years ago, when they just basically, you know, killed countless members of ethnic minorities, a lot of people lost, like, their entire family. I mean, they are the survivors of genocide. And also, as people talk now more and more about how trauma, it's like passed down through the generations. I mean, they are a people scarred by genocide and persecution. So the thing is, so I've been abroad for so long, and I heard the prosecutor's argument, and he was talking about the Middle East, and my family actually lived in the Middle East for a long time. So I was like, oh, that's really interesting. I think it also helped me report, because I've never been intimidated or felt like uncomfortable in that town, because I'm just so used to, like, Middle Eastern culture. But I didn't understand at the time that it could be seen as controversial, because I hadn't been home. And the thing is, you know, when people always accuse, like, the media being, like, politically correct, I've always denied it. And what I've slowly come to realize is, like, the reason I've denied it is because I'm not politically correct in the negative sense of the word. I'm not scared to talk about things. I'm also not scared to say the wrong thing, because either I genuinely don't think it's wrong and can explain why, or if I'm wrong, I'll be like, oh, okay. Like, I have no problems apologizing if I misunderstood something, which is uncommon in Sweden. Swedes never apologize. So I think, but then it took a while. Like, I think they talk about it now, and Sweden's been under attack for being so politically correct and naive, and, you know, the way some people talk about us abroad, like, it's like they honestly think that they're like Islamist gangs roaming the streets with semi-automatic rifle, like, raping blonde women every second. Like, that's not the case. So it's been a very, like, black and white picture. But I think, so what we've done, which some people might think is like the, like, not very, like, the non-courageous way out or compromise, is we talk about cultural values and integration. And Sweden also knows that, like we have a housing shortage. And if you just shove tons of people into these, like, not very well-maintained areas with this, basically, I mean, the housing looks like something from the Soviet Union, like these horrible, I mean, like, it's not social housing, but kind of, and it's just unattractive and alienating. So Sweden knows that, like, this was possibly not the best idea. But the segregation, the actual geographical segregation, which in Stockholm is ridiculous, also means that a lot of people who are in power, like, you know, civil servants and politicians, they just don't understand the problems because they don't see it. And I have friends who are just like, oh, I've never been there, like a suburb. And I've been everywhere in Stockholm. But people are like, oh, I heard it's a no-go zone. I'm like, well, I went there last week, so I had no problems. I had no problems going there. Saying that, I think it's easier to move about as a woman in some situations, because you're perceived as non-threatening.
Tell me more about that. Sorry to cut in, Jim. Yeah, tell me more about that. Is that something that you thought was useful in the when you were researching this case?
No, I didn't think about it consciously. I was actually being interviewed by another crime reporter when a member of the audience asked this question, and I'm like, oh, I never reflected on it. And she's like, no, but I really think so. Because, like, you're welcome into situations where you would never be welcome. And for people who belong to more conservative communities, I mean, like, you're polite to everyone, but you really are, like, super polite to women and you take care of women. And I haven't analyzed whether it helped, but I'm not gonna, like, say that it didn't.
It sounds like the community you were speaking to have a natural mistrust of authority. And you speak about that quite a lot in the book, and how that was very, very difficult to... It helped the network because it meant that people wouldn't report them to the police, yeah, because there was a culture within those communities of dealing with things in-house effectively, which allowed them to practice extortion. So from your perspective, how do you approach interviewing people who have that mistrust in the first place, but also where you know they're afraid of retribution? Must have been very difficult to get people to speak.
You know, it wasn't that difficult to get people to speak, because I knew quite a few people in the community that kind of were like, you know, they're like, I vouch for her. She's cool, you know. The problem came about, and specifically also after the death threat was, like, made public when I decided to speak about it, was that a few people tried to pull out of the book. So basically, like, interviewing people, not a problem. And everyone, the thing is, because these are sensitive issues, not just dangerous, but like sensitive. I always let people read their chapters because I don't want to be, I want to be like, not just a good journalist, but a good person. So everyone had actually signed off on their chapters, but two people, one was like, I can't do it. I've been awake all night. She emailed me at like 4 a.m. and said that people were talking about the book in the town and she was really concerned. So I found a compromise that she was happy with. And then another person tried to pull out and I just basically spoke to him. And what happened was that I removed one of his quotes and he wanted to be anonymous in certain sections. And that's fine. But like, and his response, which I didn't take personally because I understood that it came from fear, was to get like really angry with me and said I had misrepresented him. And I was like, but actually this, you've read this chapter. Like I added some stuff and I can take that out. But so that's, that happened. And I'm just trying to think. So yeah, but no, that was a problem. I just think that like I never want to be like a manipulative reporter. Because basically being a good reporter is like being a normal good person. Like, you know, if I met you for the first time and I knew, I don't know, something really like difficult in your life, I wouldn't be like, hi, nice to meet you. Can you tell me about the time, blah, blah, blah. Like I would get to know you first because it would be rude and insensitive to do that. And like the rules for journalism are different. And I just try to, you know, with the second book, is about a witness that was murdered. Like his father SMS'd me the other day and like thanked me for being so sensitive towards like the victims of crime and said he thought the book would help his grandkids like deal with their trauma. So I just figure like if my kid had been murdered, like how would I want to be treated? I also feel a responsibility, especially now when people are so critical of MSM, mainstream media, whatever that means, to just be like 100% legit and never act in a way that makes people question not just me, but like the press corps, because we need really to try to build trust.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Stakhanov's brand new show, My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson, launches this Wednesday. Clive will be quizzing some of the world's most interesting celebrities, including Griff Rhys-Jones and Shappy Kosandi, about their own personal Seven Wonders of the World. Join Clive and his first guest, Dara O'Brien, this Wednesday. Dara talks to Clive about his love for the Irish sport hurling and some of the extra benefits that come with owning a hurley stick.
It's just pleasant to have a big stick in the house every so often. For home security, it's always nice to know that I have an arsenal if I need it.
I'll bear that in mind if I'm tempted to burgle your house in the middle of the night.
Just do it. Honestly, that's how I stand. I stand naked with my Irish testicles dangling, challenging people.
They discuss finding humour in quantum physics.
It's like saying, is the cat dead or not? Would somebody just open the box?
and discovering new passions during lockdown.
Lockdown ran a schism, essentially, between the young comics who immediately went, I must learn new skills, I must learn video editing or TikTok, and I must find new ways to bring my comedy to people. And the older comics went, yeah, retirement will be all right, actually. Sit in the garden. Turns out, you know, it's okay.
It's not too bad.
Search My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson on your favourite podcast player to hear the first episode this Wednesday.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stakhanov production.
As the clock edged towards the 90th minute, there hadn't been any more goals from either side, and then the referee's whistle sounded. As extra time began, Passion sank into a kind of squat, a sort of prayer position. She stayed there for the first 5 minutes. Nothing. Then another five. Still nothing. With 4 minutes left and with a penalty shootout looming, Jonsson answered her prayers. The third goal in the 116th minute. This was it. They'd done it. They were going to stay in Allsvenskan. Passion flew to her feet. She hadn't been able to speak all day, yet all of a sudden she was screaming. She interrupted her screaming only to start laughing. Tears of joy streaked down her cheeks.
Welcome back to the Book Club with Jim and me, and today with Anne Thunqvist, the author of Follow Fucking Orders. Really appreciating the chance to sit with you today, Anne. Thanks so much for joining us. I just had a bit of fika in the break. Did you get your fika? Mm-hmm. Did you get your fika on? It's something I'm very, very drawn to in the course of this.
Fikas are great. I had half an apple. That's not as exciting.
Okay.
I feel like when people hear like fika, they imagine all these like Swedes eating like Danish pastries and drinking really expensive coffee. I had an apple. Incredibly unexciting.
That is exactly what I imagined. I was slightly disappointed now. Anyway, we're talking today about your book, which is about the gangland murder of a promising footballer. So we wanted to talk a bit more about Eddie Musa, because Jim and I kind of wondered if it was because of his sort of aspirational qualities as this really good footballer who was something in the community that this story got covered so much more broadly than perhaps it might have been, despite the fact, of course, that this was in a huge organised crime ring, but adding to it that level of, like, I don't know, almost glamour, you might say. Did that have an impact on how the story was reported?
No, I definitely think so. I mean, Södertälje was always kind of like known as a bit rough, like bad things happened down there, but there weren't that many details. I mean, the police had been trying to, like, make things better for years, but there was never this like big targeted operation. So the brothers, Eddie Musa and his brother, were killed just after midnight. So already in the morning, like if you know, CFAX is that on TV, like they had somehow like found out that it was a football player. So that was, you know, within less than a day that was known. And, you know, because it took me a while to write the book, the book was published like 8 years after the murder. And if I mention it, people like wouldn't really know any details, but everyone remembered that a football player was killed.
So at the time the story came out, was it a big deal in Sweden? Would this have been one of those sort of inescapable stories that's on the front pages for days at a time?
I mean, it definitely was front page at least for one day. But also I remember when the funeral, like the newspapers did send reporters and photographers. There's a bit about the funeral in the book, because there was just like, it was like a scene out of Sons of Anarchy, you know, because a motorcycle gang showed up and there was like police helicopters and they were like civilian police officers trying to be discreet and totally failing, just like, you know, loitering about with cameras because they're obviously like gathering evidence of who's there. So it was a bit of a spectacle. One of the people who was there told me. And then this huge police investigation where they used a lot of wiretaps took, I'm trying to think. So so Eddie and his brother were killed in like 1st of July, and it took like more than a year later to actually indict the suspects. To bring charges against them, because there were so many of them. There were 17. So that was a huge trial. So that was obviously like covered. And but then, you know what, like, media is like, so there was this kind of like weird scandal because they were all convicted more or less, but we have this system in Sweden where we don't have a jury of like professional or sort of like citizen jury members. We have lay judges that help the presiding judge, and they don't even have to have like a legal background or like a law degree. They're appointed by the local political parties. I'm sorry, I'm being super nerdy, but the point is, like, they, one of them had been during the trial also attending meetings when the police debriefed the local politicians about how the investigation was going. So that was a total conflict of interest. So the whole thing was a mistrial. And, you know, this trial went on for like months and months, and then they had to redo it. So then the story was just like, oh my God, like, conflict of interest. And they were convicted again. And then, I mean, so I reported from it went to appeal. So I went to the appeals court trial, and there were only like three journalists there. It was me, the local newspaper crime reporter, and then another reporter who also wrote a book about this case. I think my book is better, but you don't have to tell him that. But
you know, this goes out. Yeah.
We'll just have this. No, it's fine. I think he knows that. I would add as a caveat that he's written a very classical Swedish like nonfiction book, which is just like chock a block with details. Whereas I, who was educated in the US, have done it like American style, like narrative nonfiction. You know, when you're actually. So I think the question of quality comes down to what genre one prefers.
Anyway, now you've just got the backups of all your colleagues. Perfect moment.
No, he's pretty chill. His name is Barish. I think Barish is cool with this.
Glad to hear it. Okay, so it was the point being that it was a long running case that went on and on.
And the news, like, you know, news reporters move on to other things.
Yeah, but you were stuck into this, and you were following it all throughout the appeal. When it looked, you, of course, in the course of the story, you play it up how likely it is that these guys might get away with it. How likely did it feel?
I mean, this was the first trial that I really covered in depth. I'd been kind of a general news reporter before that. So there were so many wiretaps, you know, so many conversations, so many like pull out quotes that obviously show that Bernard Curry was in charge. I mean, the book's title, Follow Fucking Orders, is from a conversation where he phones his cousin, who has the media nickname The Torpedo, and tells him, when I give you orders, you follow fucking orders. So, I mean, that's what he said. But the thing, and there was a lot of forensic evidence, but none of it was smoking gun quality.
Because Curry was trying to say that he wasn't in charge, right? That was the way he was going to get out of it.
He was kind of saying like there were other people who also had, who might have had both interest and capability of orchestrating such a complicated murder, because it took a lot of planning. And they also said, all of them said like, oh, we sound really tough. Like all these recorded conversations, we sound really tough. We're always insulting each other's mothers and calling each other like son of a whore. And generally being like quite rude and aggressive. And they're like, it's just cultural. And I remember thinking like, I'm like, there's not a single person in my book who belongs to the same community as you who would agree with it being cultural, because they think it's rather embarrassing. Of course, they could also just mean like the criminal culture. So... And the interesting thing about the trial, which I think is in the book, is just like, I mean, these like differences between worlds is very, very apparent. I mean, all the defense lawyers are white, middle class or upper middle class, and come from like wealthier parts of Sweden. They speak very correct Swedish. So there's like a huge class difference. And to go just slightly off on a tangent, but tying it to Britain, there was this book called The Secret Barrister. Mm. Remember that? Mm. And that book also goes into these like huge, like the class differences, the people who judge and the people who are being judged. So like Curry and his friends were just like, you don't understand how we speak to each other, and there's no smoking gun. But the thing is that one could argue it's circumstantial evidence, but like, at some point, the sheer amount and therefore the weight of the circumstantial evidence becomes totally crushing, you know. And I mean, beyond reasonable doubt cannot only hinge on forensic evidence. I mean, and I've seen in Sweden, it's actually documented by researchers, that the district courts are becoming more and more likely to acquit people because there's no, they call it like definitive technical evidence. And I, you know, sometimes I've like, you know, be sitting like reading it, like a verdict, and I'm like, what? You know, for me, it's so obvious that this person has committed the crime. Mm. And of course, it has to be beyond reasonable doubt. But sometimes it's just like, you know, you don't actually need DNA on a gun to prove that someone like was holding it when it was fired and killed someone. Mm.
There seems to be a recurring kind of theme throughout the book, particularly later on as you're interviewing witnesses and the family members of the people involved, that people say there was too much focus on Khoury in the investigation, and that there might be people that did escape justice by staying out of sight. And do you think there's a likelihood of that, or is that the local community believing the smokescreen that Khoury himself was trying to put up, this idea that he wasn't the boss?
No, I think they're correct in the way that if you follow the prosecutor's argument as well, that it's so entrenched. So, I mean, like, you know, let's say that it was me that lent money to someone who didn't pay back, and I just employed Khoury to get it back by being like a fist-wielding crazy person. If I am a person who actually regularly lends large amounts of money to local entrepreneurs, I'm obviously like the, you know, the head honcho of a loan sharking operation, but you can't, it's difficult to target them. So, I mean, you could say that, I mean, that Khoury was just a contractor, that, you know, like renting out services. So I've never seen any of them brought to justice. And the Swedish police often refer to like the pyramid of crime, which is that, I mean, Khoury and his friends were like the gang, like they were visible, they were out there, they were scary. But then you have the people who are like, not even necessarily orchestrating it. I usually think of it as a business model, and the easiest way is to talk about narcotics. So like someone has to import the narcotics, right? Very complicated, very expensive operation. And then, and this is kind of hilarious, but in a macabre way. So they just brought down this like drug ring just like last week. And they have these like depots where they have all the narcotics, but then you have to like get it to the retailers, basically. So all these gangs are usually busy like shooting each other and being upset with each other for random bullshit. They take out an insurance policy in a way because they pool their resources, and then all of a sudden the gang members are like, oh, we have to rent a van, high five. And then all these people who are actually rivals on paper are sitting there in the van going like, oh, here's our roadmap, and we have to drop off X kilos over here, and then we'll take motorway number 5, you know. So I mean the thing about mafia is, I mean, it's business. It's all about business. They wouldn't exist if like they didn't have customers.
And so I initially thought that Eddie Moussa, when I first started reading it, I assumed that in some way Eddie Moussa's kind of notoriety as a footballer was involved in how he caught the eye of this local mafia. But is it more that he was trying to get into their turf a little bit with his small, tiny loan operation?
I don't know how big it was, but we know of the gambling loan sharking. The police always said that this was one of the reasons for him being killed. Now, his sister was just like, they've never proved it. And I understand her saying that in her grief. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, but you're not going to like launch a criminal investigation against a person who's dead, you know? So like there was no incentive for them to look into it further. But I mean, all my interview people have said this. Eddie's the cousin of one of the people in the book, and she knows everything about it. And so I can't conclusively say this was the case, but it also becomes one of those beyond reasonable doubt things, because when enough people say it, they might not be able to, like, you know, show a bank account statement and be like, look, where did these X million kroner come from? But it also, like, you have to be, okay, so rumors, you have to be sensitive to the fact that sometimes something that's incorrect can become an established truth, which is why I haven't put everything in the book that I have heard about Eddie, because I just decided that like I don't have, this is not valuable enough for me to spend X days on to corroborate. So, but he grew up with Khoury. They were friends. I mean, they all knew each other, and obviously things just turned really sour. And I mean, Bernard's cousin being paralyzed in drive-by shooting is really not going to, you know, make things simmer down in the community.
The police and the investigators said they'd never had to protect so many people in connection with one investigation. It was around 20 families.
Yeah, and some of the families are quite big. So it's like the witness protection program. You can do different things. You can help people move and actually like change their name and change their, like, I mean, the equivalent to a social security number. So, or you can just make sure to like scrub all information about them from public records so they're impossible to find. So yeah, they broke a record. They've never had to help that many people. I mean, they helped me too after the death threat. I obviously haven't changed my name, but I mean, I'm impossible to find in public records. The only thing that this affects in terms of my life quality is that the tax agency, there's like a small unit in the tax agency who's allowed to work with us people with hidden identities. So every time I have a tax question, I'm like, hi, it's me again. They're like, oh God.
This woman more efficient.
You know, it is kind of like I needed help, and I just emailed one of them the other day, and I'm like, yeah, I don't have to sit in, like, you know, in a telephone queue for 2 hours like everyone else in this country.
Sounds a bit as though you're making the best of this, though, because you had to like leave your job at one point after he made death threats to you, Curry.
Yeah, no, because I was the beat reporter for the local radio in his hometown, Sotelia, and they were just like, I mean, there was no way for me to stay there. I mean, even if he was just making a threat to scare me and had absolutely no intention of enacting it, I mean, he told people to go talk to me and basically bring a gun and threaten me. It's impossible to know. And as like the head of security at my job said, he's like, in this kind of situation, coming in second place isn't an option, because second place is like you being dead. I'm like, great. So, I mean, they took it seriously. But I mean, I kind of logically knew that he would have very little to gain from actually killing me, but just this tiny, tiny possibility, this, you know, and also the feeling of knowing that people in these criminal circles were talking about me, and small stuff, like someone tried to log into my like Facebook account. I mean, it sounds so innocuous. I mean, it's like not, I mean, I'm sure that's happened to you, but when it all happens at the same time and you like end up being a bit paranoid, you're like, you know, looking over your shoulder. It's quite taxing. I mean, it's been a while now, and I'm like mostly fine about it, but it was possibly the worst period of my entire life.
Is it something that you would kind of, that you were concerned about before it actually happened? Because you met Corey in person, didn't you? You saw how imposing he is. You saw firsthand the influence he has. And it's, you know, it takes a certain element of bravery to even, to kick a hornet's nest like that. And was the eventuality of you being threatened something that you had kind of prepared for in advance mentally?
Do you know, I was worried, but I was mostly worried about the people whom I had interviewed. So there's like two main people in the book. One's a woman and one's a man. And she's also kind of innocent in the way that the debt that they were trying to enforce from her was not hers, it was her brother's. And they don't go after women. You know, they have this self-image of being so respectful to women. This is a podcast, so your listeners can't see how I'm rolling my eyes. But I wasn't worried about her, but I was worried about him, because I was just like, I mean, he has moved. He has a new identity and a new, you know, everything. But I kept, there's this scene in The Sopranos, you know, the TV series, where Tony Soprano is just out driving. He stops at a petrol station to fill up his car. And by accident, he runs into this guy who like testified against him a few years ago, and he just strangles him on the spot. So that scene was like playing on repeat. And also, so, I mean, I live in a flat, and if people, like if someone came in through the, like the, what's it called? The door downstairs, you know, from the street, like it would wake me up. And then I would lie awake and analyze the sound of the footsteps on the stairs. After the death threat, I actually bought a new, like, heavy-duty door, like, not a front door, like, not a... It's not bulletproof, but it's, like, thicker, and it isolates from the sound. So, I mean, I was just worried about him. And then, obviously, I was worried about me, too, but I never thought they were going to, like, shoot me. But what I was worried about was that they would show up, like, force their way into the house, like, take out a gun and like place it demonstratively on the table and just like have a talking to, or worst case scenario, that they would like shoot me in the knee. I mean, the thing is, I mean, I don't know if you agree, but I at least think I'm a person with a bit of like humor. And when I thought about this possibility of them shooting me in the knee, I remember thinking, well, at least, I mean, because I played quite high division volleyball for years. I'm like, well, at least I'm not like a volleyball player anymore. So I won't like fuck up my volleyball.
But that's the nature of threats, isn't it? Perhaps realistically or in truth, you didn't fully imagine that anything terminal, I don't know, could happen to you, Anne. But it's the fact that there is the sense of doubt. Yeah, that's the scary thing. That's in fact, in one way, that's how it all worked. That's how he tied everyone to him.
No, exactly, because it's just because your body goes into fight or flight mode. I mean, it's not like you have control over it. And I was actually just helping this NGO. I was like kind of an informal consultant. They were drafting a list of like tips for employers to think about if their employees are threatened or just, you know, in comfortable situations. And it's a long list. But one of the things I said was just like, there were some people in the newsroom who were like, oh, you know, They were trying to comfort me by saying like, oh, don't worry, it's not going to happen. They have nothing to gain from it. And I knew they were trying to be nice, but it's just like you feel really belittled because it almost feels like they're saying, oh, you have nothing to worry about. But, you know, I was having problems sleeping. I was losing weight. And also truthfully, so I didn't live at home for a while and then I moved home. And by total random coincidence, a friend of a friend needed somewhere to live. So I was like, oh, well, come and stay with me for a while. I was thinking like a month, maybe two, before he finds a new flat. He lived with me for a year. And thank God he was here because I came home to someone. We didn't talk about like Kuri all the time, but just not living alone was... And I remember one like Friday he was out late and I was lying in bed. I was like so tense. Mm. And I ended up having to, like, I went for a really long walk because I just needed him to be there.
You said that you never considered not publishing the book. Do you think it was, I mean, this is a conversation you have with one of the main witnesses at the end of the book, isn't it? Do you think it was worth it feeling this way?
I mean, I think fear is like pain. It passes. And you have, you know how like, so this is maybe a weird parallel, but you know how people like give birth and it's the worst thing ever. And then they have another kid and you're like, what? Like,
I know exactly what you mean.
So it's like, you know, they can say that it's the worst pain ever, but they're not living through that pain right now. So you just do it again. I mean, I wrote another book. These people in the second book were nowhere near as scary as The Network and Kuri, but I waited for a while before I did like wrote this second book. But I think that was more because I was exhausted after this first book and the death threat and blah, blah, blah. I actually worked part-time for a while because I was on sick leave. I basically went to my doctor and was like, hi, you're going to put me on sick leave because if you don't put me on sick leave part-time now, you'll be putting me on sick leave full-time within a few months, which doesn't benefit society or the Social Security Agency's budget. You know, I was like totally prepared.
Oh my goodness.
It wasn't like...
That is like how we imagine Sweden.
Yeah, because I was just like, this makes no sense, like that, you know, that you would let me just like have a total breakdown and then I wouldn't be able to work for 2 years and I wouldn't pay taxes and I'd be on like social benefits. I was like, the maths doesn't add up.
Oh, I'm really sorry to hear all this. It's
it's fine now and I'm glad I did it. I mean, when I think about things I should have done differently, it's all like structural, like in I should have had a chapter outline before I started like writing, you know. It's more like about like the handicraft and stuff that made the second book much easier to write.
And how is the football club doing today, Asteriska?
Well, they're doing okay. They've had like financial problems back and forth. Like originally because they spent a lot of money on like recruiting players.
Instead of building them up, right? This was one of the things that one of the guys you spoke to is constantly complaining about. Because they've got a few internationals certainly that they produce, this football club, including Mikhail Ishak, and Champman fans might remember Kennedy Bakisolu. Jim's nodding, I think.
Yeah,
he was,
yeah.
He was kind of a wacky guy who, 14 caps or something. So they definitely produced a few players.
No, they definitely have. But, you know, because I used to play like competitive volleyball and coach, I also know that when it comes to teams, you have to strike a balance because you want to be fair to like your base. So I would have players who'd been part of the club for years. But then you need new talent, partly for like fresh blood, but also because like, you know, top level players will raise the game for everyone. Like the less strong players will learn from them. The tempo will increase. So I understand the Swedish guy. It's a very difficult balancing game. But the funny thing is, so like, there's a Syriska, but there's also their like local rivals, Syrianska, who are also Orthodox Christians from the Middle East. And some people are like, we're basically the same people. We just use different terminology. And they're total rivals, and derbies are really like a bit crazy. I've been there. I quite like them. But so I was giving a lecture in Södertälje, and my police bodyguards were there with me. And they still protect me when I give lectures down there. And then after the lecture, these like three young men came up to speak to me. And it turned out that one was a Syriska player and the other two were Syrianska players. And I was like, dude, what's happening? Like, everyone knows that you should just like become one big club and that will sort out like your finances. And they were like, yeah, but you know, like the manager, like the board, it's just tons of old farts, you know, and they just can't even consider this. And like, they just have to retire and everything will, our generation, we don't care. You know, I'm here with like, you know, they were rival teams. I was like, okay, so we're like talking 5 years. He's like, no, I mean, some of them are like really persistent. I mean, 10 years, but they have to retire. You know? So I think, I mean, there's solutions. I mean, they're still there. I can't remember if they're in second division or third. But I mean, they're definitely there and they have a lot of youth teams and they're, you know, really important for the young community. And Syrianska has been trying to get more girls to play. I interviewed some of the girls. They were like, they were hilarious. They were like 10 and 9. And when I asked them about their favorite football player, they all said, oh God, the guy, I mean, they all referred to, oh, give me some famous footballer name.
Messi.
Yeah, Messi. All these kids were like, Messi. And I was just like, you know that there's female football?
Yeah, you need to tell them about Lucy Bronze and Marta and all of these other people. Damn right.
Yeah, and like... So, I mean, that's fascinating, but they're trying. And I have huge fondness for this town. I think it's, I mean, like there's the harbor area, which is like turn of last century. That's really pretty. It's very verdant. I mean, some people might think that like the word a beautiful industrial city is like a contradiction in terms, but it's just the mix of like history and like modernity and vibrant industry. And it's situated, I mean, it's really beautiful. Like the, you know, it's on this canal connecting to a lake. So, I mean, it's a really nice town.
Oh, Anne, well, I have to say, Football Ramble presents our podcasts take you places you never expect to go sometimes. And I think this is definitely no exception.
Well, thank you for having me. It was really nice speaking to you. And I hope that people aren't too scared to visit Sweden.
Yeah, I can vouch for it from my own personal experience. It's a wonderful place. And thanks again for joining us. Where should people go if they want to pick up your book or your books?
The books are available online from most major retailers. So just clickety click, and then there is also a audiobook, which is on Audible, and I recorded it myself, so you can hear me pretending to be gangsters and cops and. disgruntled football fans and victims of extortion and reporting live from the trial. And one of my readers was like, the chapter about the trial was really boring. I'm like, yeah, because the trials are horrible. They are boring. That's the entire point.
Oh, Anne, well, thank you so much for joining us today on the Book Club. It's been an absolute delight. Antonka's book, Follow Fucking Orders, out now with Pitch Publishing. We'll post a link to where you can get it on our socials as well. It really is an incredibly gripping read and something, we didn't expect to necessarily be talking about on Book Club. I've absolutely loved. Let us know what we should read next. I'm at KVL Mason. Jim?
I'm at Jim Campbell TFR.
And we'll catch you next time for another episode of Book Club on Football Ramble Presents.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com. Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's UnitedHealthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, UnitedHealthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about UnitedHealthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.